them ready and fit for the divine proximity and divine neighborhood, so that we become the neighbors of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We become fit to have that beatific vision in paradise.
The soul is very difficult to define, but in a simple expression, it is what we call I, the one who wills, who decides, who judges, who loves and hates, the one who uses the body as a means towards its end. We usually think that these are functions of the mind, while the mind is a simple conglomeration of absolutely separate cells.
We have to see what defines a person. Is it the body, or is it the me within the body? When we're growing up as kids, we have that me in us. As we grow older, we feel that this same me that I had when I was a kid is still that same me. Of course, experiences are added to me, but the me is the same me. We can't fool ourselves. As we grow older and older, the same me again and again. So, does the person die? We have to see. The body will die for sure. The body is destroyed for sure, but the person, no, the person will live on. That me, or in other words, the soul, is going to live on.
Meccans asked the Prophet, tell us what the ruh is, what is the spirit? He said, يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الرُّوحِ قُلِ الرُّوحُ مِنْ أَمْرِ رَبِّي. They ask you about the soul, what it is. Tell them that the soul is my Lord's command. And that's all you can understand. You can't understand more than that. And of course, you know, when I say you can't understand more than that, you know, some people will say, well, we live in a very enlightened age of science and technology and information, and we have everything on our fingertips. But let me tell you, you know, the best minds in physics, the best minds in biochemistry, the best minds in genetics, best minds in technology and engineering, and in every field will say to you, we only know this much. We only know this much of the physical world.
It is true that the soul knows this world by the help of body and its different organs. And if it was not for the body, the soul would have not known anything. It is as the Quran mentions, وَاللَّهُ أَخْرَجَكُمْ مِنْ بُطُونِ أُمَّهَاتِكُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ شَيْئًا وَجَعَلَ لَكُمُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارَ وَالْأَفْئِدَةَ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَشْكُرُونَ. God has brought you forth from the wombs of your mothers while you did not know anything. He made for you hearing, eyesight, and hearts so that you may appreciate. Mutually, if it was not for the soul, the body would not have been able to do anything. Death happens when the soul leaves the body. The question is, what would the soul do without the body, which was its only means to every end? The answer is that it lives in another body.
When you die, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts your soul in another body. Now, let's say it like this. You have a body once you die as well. And you will eat, you will drink, and so on. Or you will be punished to an extent. And this is called the mithali body, they call it. Which means that you have that same shape and form, but you don't have material anymore. Okay? So you have height, width, maybe length, but you don't have that material. Okay? It's not something tangible. And that's why we, in this realm of life, we can't see those who have passed away.
The soul is the real us. The body is a vehicle. That's why when, for example, we look in the mirror and we say, I, we don't mean this body with its limbs. If we were to lose a hand tomorrow and look in the mirror, we'll still say I and mean the same thing. We won't say I less five fingers. So we have an understanding of the real us, what we refer to as I. This soul requires, depending on which environment it is in, a body of sorts, and there will be a more subtle body that it occupies as it moves on into Barzakh, and an even more subtle body that it occupies when it moves into the Day of Judgment.
Death is really a move from one realm of existence into another. It is moving from the physical world, the material world, the touchable world, the tangible world, into the realm of spirit, the realm that is spiritual, the realm that is beyond and above the laws of physics, really, gravitation or material or physical things actually don't exist in that world. It's a world of its own, with its own laws and with its own way of operating.
That spiritualistic communication or spiritualistic sense is simply that sense which is not materialistic, the sense which is got that third component, if we may call it.
Rumi refers to these senses in his famous book, Masnavi. There are five senses other than these five senses. Those are like red gold, while these are like copper. The prophets communicated with the angels through these senses, and the Prophet of Islam went to Mi'raj, the ascension, with his spiritual body, and heard and saw things by his spiritual senses. These senses will be activated for all after they die.
In this world, the soul is not able to manifest its true potentials. It is governed largely by the constraints of the material world around it. And it is an uneasy, if you like, passenger in the vehicle that is the body. However, there is a purpose to this existence, and the soul requires to have this phase of its existence. But it really, if you like, flies and flourishes once it is free from that fetter of the body, and that is real life.
The spiritual body grows with us as we grow in this world. In fact, we have one aspect of this rooted in the middle world, and that is why we can communicate with that world in our dreams. So in this world, we live in two bodies, but since one is like an image of the other and completely matched on it, we realize that. Now, these two bodies belong to two dimensions of the same existence. On the moment of death, the soul discards its physical body and leaves this world with its spiritual body. So when we talk of death, we actually talk of ourselves in a new body, a body which is much more complicated and much more magnificent than our physical body.
The awareness, the power of the soul that is available to it, even in Barzakh, is exponentially different to that which was available to it in life. Even the kafir and the agnostic and the atheist, their ma'rifa and knowledge of reality is much greater than any scholar who's alive now, because the veils have been lifted and they see.
So every one of us leave this world in a spiritual body, a body which is lighter, fresher, and more agile than the body in which we are living now. A body with a special DNA partially created by us in this world. But what type of experience is death? Isn't going to be the same for all? Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk about this in more details. Until then, peace be with you.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned. Why the religion of Islam emphasizes on the concept of consultation? The main reason to consult others is to have a strong basis. A strong basis in an argument causes confidence. A healthy society is the one that its people trust each other. Trust in different parts of a society makes it stronger. Even a simple promise to a child must be fulfilled in Islam, let alone to big promises in a community. Trust of a child to a father brings trust in a family, and the families form a society. Even a small promise to a child must be fulfilled. Promises between spouses must be fulfilled. Marriage gifts must be given to a wife. All these laws show that Islam has rulings for different aspects of a society. Fulfillment of promises brings about confidence and trust in a society. Promises start from the family, and they will have greater effects on larger scales in a society. All in all, the religion of Islam is based on mutual trust. Trust, if observed on both sides, will bring honor and dignity to a society. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
8-year defensive Iranian combatants
against Iran. A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
On late Saturday, April 13th, the Islamic Republic of Iran began Operation True Promise by launching explosive drones and firing missiles at Israeli-occupied territory. The Iranian salvo of more than 300 drones and missiles came almost 2 weeks after Israel targeted Iran's consulate in Damascus that resulted in the assassination of a number of high-ranking Iranians, including General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, one of Iran's most senior commanders in its Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, and Mohammad Hadi Haji Rahimi, his deputy. Operation True Promise was Tehran's first direct attack on the Israeli regime after a long period of strategic patience, a new chapter in the history of the region. A few hours before Iran launched Operation True Promise, we asked political analyst Mr. Sadullah Zarei about the possibility of a direct action by Iran against the Israeli regime.
Biden,
U.S. President Joe Biden, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and other top officials in the United States, as well as in Israel, have said that Iran would respond to the attack on its consulates in Damascus. Some have predicted that the response would be severe. When they say that the Islamic Republic would respond, it means that they are confessing to Tehran's ability to retaliate. So, Iran, in the eyes of its enemies, is both willing to and capable of taking action in retaliation against what the Israeli regime did to its diplomatic mission in Syria.
Iran's decision to retaliate against Israel from its own soil has raised many eyebrows, even as the attacks appear to be carefully calibrated to avoid a full-scale war.
We are seeking to deal a proper blow to Israel so that the regime would forget all about such reckless actions against Iran in the future. At the same time, we are not going to fan the flames of war. We don't want to escalate tensions in the region. So our strikes would be limited and calculated. In other words, we are going to take revenge without trying to drag the whole region into an all-out war. Our main aim is to deter the Israeli regime from threatening our interests in the region.
A direct attack by Iran on Israel was not believed to be on the cards. The Iranians had previously made clear that they were not seeking a war with Israel. In fact, Iran had never responded with such force to previous attacks, including many covert Israeli operations on its soil. This is Mr. Morteza Makki, a political analyst based in Tehran.
After much speculation over the past 2 weeks, the Islamic Republic of Iran eventually took retaliatory action against Israel by sending tens of drones and missiles towards the regime's critical points. Iran's action has obviously changed the game. The Israelis were under the impression that Tehran would take action indirectly through the resistance axis, for example, and would not put aside its strategic patience, but they were wrong, and as a result, the direct attack came as a shock to them.
Iran has plausible arguments for the retaliatory attack, which was a legitimate response to Israel's terrorist attack on the Islamic Republic's diplomatic premises in the Syrian capital. According to a statement issued by the Islamic Republic's mission to the United Nations, Iran's military action was based on Article 51 of the United Nations Charter concerning legitimate defense in response to the Zionist regime's aggression against our diplomatic premises in Damascus. Mr. Ahmad Momini Arad, professor of international law at Tehran University, has more to say.
The military action the Israeli regime took against Iran's consulate on April 1st is, according to international laws, an action against Iran's sovereignty. It's an illegal action under international laws. In this case, according to Article 51 of the UN Charter, Iran has the right of self-defense because an armed attack has occurred against the country. Prior to Operation True Promise, Iran had frequently asked the Security Council to take necessary measures against Israel's illegal action. But unfortunately, the Council did nothing in this regard. So Iran upheld its right of self-defense by launching an operation that was more defensive in nature than being retaliatory.
Top Iranian commanders warned Israel that the country would face a bigger attack if it retaliates against overnight drone and missile strikes. In the words of the commander-in-chief of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, Major General Hossein Salami, the Zionist regime must stop its past behavior and learn from this attack. If the Zionist regime shows any response, our reaction will certainly be much harsher based on this new experience we have gained from their capabilities. Adding, from now on, if the Zionist regime attacks our interests, assets, figures, and citizens at any point, it will face counterattack from within the Islamic Republic of Iran. Mr. Mehdi Khorsan enumerated a list of subversive actions taken by Israel against the Islamic Republic over the past years.
Assassinating our nuclear scientists, taking acts of sabotage in our nuclear sites, abortive attempt against Barakat Pharmaceutical Group, supporting secessionists in border areas, orchestrating arson attacks in Mahidash bases in Kermanshah, attacking nuclear facilities in Karaj, Natanz and other places, recruiting spies and financing terrorists. These are some actions the Israeli regime has taken against Iran over the past four decades.
Operation True Promise was unprecedented in many aspects. It was the first direct military action taken by Tehran against the Israeli regime. But can it be a game changer? Mr. Khorsan told us that Iran's first direct action against Israel was inevitable.
When the regime crossed our red lines and attacked our consulate for the first time, which is tantamount to attacking our soil, we had no option but to take a strong action. We had to shatter the regime's illusions that Iran wasn't afraid of it, and the country's strategic patience was out of fear or weakness. Fact is, whatever the regime had done prior to its attack on Iran's consulate did not require Tehran to take a direct military action against the regime.
The scale of Iran's attack, the diversity of locations it targeted, and weapons it used forced Israel to uncover the majority of anti-missile technologies the U.S. and the regime have across the region. A big achievement at low cost. Tehran did not use any weapons Israel didn't know it had. It just used a lot of them. Iran likely now has almost a full map of what Israel's missile systems looks like, as well as where in Jordan and the Persian Gulf the U.S. has installations. It also knows how long it takes to prepare them or how Israeli society responds. This is a huge strategic cost to Israel. While some Arab states are now being blasted by their people, particularly the Jordanian monarchy, for not doing anything to protect Gazans, but then going all out to protect Israel. Mr. Mackey told us why Tehran launched drones and missiles simultaneously.
Israel's system is multi-layer. The first layer is supposed to intercept rockets, the second layer to intercept mid-range missiles, and the third layer to intercept long-range missiles. By sending drones, Iran aimed at disrupting the first layer, and by sending missiles of different ranges Iran managed to change the second and the third layers of the Iron Dome.
Iran can now reverse engineer all the intelligence it has gathered from this attack for future attacks if the occasion arises. That's why the U.S. and Israel will have to redesign their current model, which has been compromised. Before Iran's operation, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was moved to a bunker in Al-Quds. Zionist soldier vacations were canceled ahead of the attack, and all reservists were ordered to report for duty. Israeli forces issued warnings to settlers to avoid large gatherings while remaining close to shelters. Meanwhile, Israeli officials pleaded with their allies to do anything to stop Iran. From now on, the Israeli regime has to do all these things before taking any reckless action against Iranian interests.
The action Iran took against Israel showed just part of the country's defense capabilities. Iran has hypersonic missiles that can reach Israel in minutes. If Iran had used them, the blow to the regime would have been much more crushing. Over the past 2 weeks, Israel was a bundle of nerves, and you know, Netanyahu cannot keep going like this. In case of another attack by Israel, Iran would not wait for 2 weeks. Its response would be swift and severe. The fact is, we have entered a new phase of tensions in the region. Israel and its allies need to reconsider their plans. Any misstep can throw the whole region into further chaos, tension, and war. And don't forget, the victims of this situation would not be just regional countries, but also Western countries that have many interests in the region.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
To save its face, the Israeli regime has been trying to play down the significance of Operation True Promise by distorting the realities. But denying the damage doesn't undo the damage, does it? Commenting on Israel's response to the attack, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu posted on X, "We intercepted, we repelled, together we shall win." There's no doubt that Iran could carry out an operation in a large scale, but the attack was limited to the military bases of the Zionist regime, from the Golan Heights to the Negev Desert, that were used in the terrorist attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus.
The Nevatim Air Base is one of the most strategic bases of Israel and home to F-35 aircraft. By targeting this base, Iran sent a very important message to the Israeli regime that we are not afraid to launch direct attacks from our own soil. On the contrary, we can fearlessly send swarms of drones and missiles toward Israel, challenging its Iron Dome and striking our targets vehemently. We are ready for the ultimate goal of annihilating the child-killing regime.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said on Sunday that Iran gave neighboring countries and Israel's ally, the United States, 72 hours' notice it would launch the strikes. It means that the Islamic Republic was not after a surprise attack or dealing a bloody blow to Israel, but giving the regime a serious ultimatum. Thanks to the notice, Israel could prepare itself with the help of the U.S. and some other allies for Iran's attack. And yet, the regime was not fully successful in intercepting the drones and missiles. And it means a surprise full-force attack by Iran would land the regime in serious trouble. According to General Salami, dozens of ballistic and cruise missiles managed to break into deep layers of Israel's seemingly safe air defense system, impact the aerial coalition between the U.S., France, and Israel and reach the designated target. Asked Mr. Zohri about the potential consequences of Iran's retaliatory attack. He said that Israel should be more afraid of them, not Iran.
سوال: آیا اسرائیلی‌هایی که نتونستن علی‌رغم حدود 88 روز
I've got a simple question to ask. Can an impotent regime like Israel stand against the Islamic Republic of Iran? The answer is no. How can a regime which is unable to defeat a resistance group like Hamas defeat Iran? As you know, Hamas is just a resistance group in Gaza, which has been under siege for years. The group has very limited facilities. It has no armed vehicles, no navy, no air force, no classic army. And yet the Israeli regime has failed to defeat this group over the past 6 or 7 months.
The Iranian missile and drone attacks came as a shock to settlers in the occupied territories, since the Israeli media had tried to pacify them for weeks, claiming that Iran's intention for retaliation was not true. However, at the stroke of midnight, both the Israeli media and settlers were gripped by fear. The operation has opened a new chapter for Iran in the fight against the Israeli regime. It included at least 4 waves of drone attacks. The retaliatory military operation also included the launch of a series of cruise and ballistic missiles, which were reportedly accompanied by simultaneous drone and missile strikes by the Axis of Resistance groups from Iraq, Yemen, and Lebanon. According to official reports, Shahed 136 kamikaze drones that carry a relatively small warhead weighing some 50 kilograms were used in the attack on Israel. Moreover, the Shahed 238, which is powered by a turbojet rather than the propeller on the 136 model, was also used in the attack. The Emad long-range ballistic missile and the Pavek cruise missile were used to attack Israel. Iran also possesses Fatah, a hypersonic ballistic missile that could theoretically arrive in Israel in as little as 7 minutes, along with a cruise missile variant of the same family. There was no indication the missiles were used in the early Sunday attacks. After all, it was a slap on the wrist, and Iran's response to any further military action by Israel will be much greater. Iranian Parliament Speaker Mohammad Baqir Ghalibaf said, "The Iranian forces' deterrence and regret-inducing response delighted the hearts of every Iranian who cares about our honored country's security and glory." In a phone call with Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on the attack night, U.S. President Joe Biden made clear the U.S. would not participate in any offensive operations against Iran, an implicit acceptance that a military confrontation with Iran would cost both Israel and the U.S. dearly.
The Americans know that they are very vulnerable in the region, and they don't want to engage with Iran. Needless to say, we are not after war with the Americans either. The other day, a White House National Security Communications Advisor, John Kirby, said that Israel's attack on Iran's consulate was legitimate, but in the same breath, he said that the action was reckless and against the United States policies. Why did he add that to his remarks? Because he is afraid of his country being dragged into war with Iran. The Americans didn't have a good time in Iraq or in Afghanistan, and they don't want to repeat the same mistake. And you know, these two countries are not comparable with Iran.
Operation True Promise has mocked Israel's invincibility myth, stripping the regime of its deterrence illusion. The Islamic Republic of Iran, under the leadership of Ayatollah Khamenei, has once again given a new momentum to the Palestinian cause.
With the great strength Iran showed, the country conveyed the message that we are capable of launching massive operations, and any attack on our soil or consulates will be faced with crushing responses. The operation, in fact, sought to restore Iran's deterrence. I have to say that over the past years, Iran has been acting in a rational way and in accordance with international laws. It has never sought to begin war or open up new fronts in the region.
whatever the Islamic Republic has done so far has been defensive and preemptive.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, had in his Eid al-Fitr sermon vowed to punish the Israeli regime for the mistake of targeting the Iranian diplomatic mission in Damascus. He made a similar warning a day after the attack was carried out earlier this month, saying the regime would be punished. The Islamic Revolution Guard Corps dubbed the operation True Promise to show Iran leaders seriousness on his vows of punishment for attacks by Israel and others.
By targeting Iran's consulate in Damascus, Israel tried to challenge Iran's deterrence. Given what Ayatollah Khamenei said at Eid al-Fitr sermons, it became clear that Iran would not let Israel go unpunished this time. Now, the region should brace itself for new military and political developments. What would be these developments? It all depends on how the Israeli regime would react to Iran's retaliatory attack and the stance the Americans are going to adopt.
Shortly after the retaliation, Iranians took to the streets at Palestine Square and in front of the University of Tehran in the capital, waving national flags and chanting slogans in support of the retaliatory attack. Similar demonstrations were held in other parts of the country. Rallies were also held on the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the holy occupied city of Al-Quds, where Palestinians came out to celebrate after hearing news of the Iranian retaliation. People also took to the streets throughout various cities across the world, celebrating Iran's decisive retaliation against the Israeli regime.
Operation True Promise was recorded as the biggest missile operation as well as the biggest drone operation in the world. The operation cheered up the people of Palestine, the people of the region, and the people of the world, all the freedom-seeking people around the globe who take pity on the children and women of Gaza. The operation was designed in a way so as to avoid non-military targets and therefore collateral damage. It was a very precise and calculated operation.
On the eve of Iran's retaliatory attack, Israel suspended the ground invasion of the city of Rafah in southern Gaza because it did not know how, where, and when Iran would give its retaliatory response. The night Iran carried out Operation True Promise, no one lost his or her life to Israel's indiscriminate airstrikes as the regime was busy defending itself against Iran's retaliation. Iran, under the severest sanctions, did what the Arab coalition had failed to do over the past seven decades, to humiliate the Israeli regime and scare the life out of it. The rules of engagement have changed. Operation True Promise marks the beginning of a new era when the regime can no longer get away with murder. From now on, the regime's first mistake could be its last one, and there's absolutely harm in trying it. We asked Dr. Momin Yerod if the Israeli regime has the right to launch a retaliatory attack against Iran in response to its retaliatory attack.
If we consider the case from the point of view of international laws, no, the regime has no right to attack Iran again. But the fact is, the regime has never abided by international laws and norms since its formation. It has crossed all the red lines and it has committed crimes unprecedented in history. The regime's history is brimmed with all kinds of violations of international laws, of human rights, you name it. It has a track record of illegal occupation of Palestine, invasion, killing, genocide, assassination, displacement of people, destruction of homes, and so on and so forth.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Till next time, take care.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of this series in which we try to present you a fluent and easy to understand exegesis of God's final scripture to mankind, the Noble Quran. If you remember, we finished the exegesis of Surah Muzammil, and today we are going to start Surah Al-Mudassir. Today, we will explain 14 ayahs of this surah. Stay with us, please. Surah Al-Mudathir has 56 ayahs and was revealed in Mecca. According to the exegetes of the Noble Quran, this surah was revealed after Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, had been commanded to publicize his mission. Like other surahs which were revealed in Mecca, Surah Al-Mudathir too contains issues such as reminding of the beginning of creation and the end, day of resurrection, struggle against polytheism, and persistence in this way. It also points to the characteristics of inmates of hell who used to mock at the truth and fight the Quran. Let us enlighten our souls with listening to ayahs 1 to 7 of Surah Al-Mudathir.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم يا أيها المدثر قم فأنذر وربك فكبر وثيابك فطهر والرجز فاهجر ولا تمنن تستكثر ولربك فاصبر.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. O you wrapped in your mantle, rise up and warn. Magnify your Lord and purify your cloak and keep away from all impurity. And do not grant a favor seeking a greater gain, and be patient for the sake of your Lord. These ayahs were revealed in direct address to the Prophet. They are related to the period when his secret invitation ended and he was missioned to invite people to God's way publicly. He is commanded to warn people against worshipping of idols and committing sins, as they will lead to evil fate both in this world and the hereafter. The Prophet is ordered to magnify his Lord, to annul all false deities, to obliterate every trace of idolatry and not allow another name to be called besides God's name. Next, he is commanded to purify both his body and heart from any impurity so that his word affects people. He is commanded to keep aloof from anything that may incur the divine wrath. Then the Prophet is prevented from granting favor on Allah for worshipping him or doing righteous deeds. Rather, you should be thankful to Allah as he has guided you and favored you to worship him and serve his servants. In the end of this part, Allah says that fulfilling the divine commands requires patience in the face of hardships. These ayahs teach us that, number one, human beings are subjected to a variety of dangers, and indeed, the prophets were missioned to awaken and warn people against those dangers in this world and the hereafter. Number two, greatness belongs only to Allah. Clearly, anyone who considers Allah great will deem others little and humble and will not prefer others to Allah. Number three, faith requires cleanness both internally and externally. Both body and heart must be purified from any impurity. And number four, we should take care not to grant favor on Allah for worshipping Him or on people for rendering services to Him, as if Allah or people are indebted to us, while it is Allah who has favored us and helped us to worship Him and do righteous deeds. Now let us listen to ayahs 8 to 14 of Surah Al-Mudathir.
فَإِذَا نُقِرَ فِي النَّاقُورِ فَذَلِكَ يَوْمَئِذٍ يَوْمٌ عَسِيرٌ عَلَى الْكَافِرِينَ غَيْرُ يَسِيرٍ ذَرْنِي وَمَنْ خَلَقْتُ وَحِيدًا وَجَعَلْتُ لَهُ مَالًا مَمْدُودًا وبنين شهودا ومهدت له تمهيدا.
When the trumpet will be sounded, that day will be a day of hardship, not at all easy for the faithless. Leave me with him whom I created alone, and then furnished him with extensive means, and gave him sons to be at his side, and facilitated all matters for him. The second ayah of this surah was about warning. These ayahs give some examples of warnings. When the day of resurrection comes, it will be a very hard day for the faithless and deniers of the hereafter, as they heard and understood the truth but rejected it. Then the ayahs refer to a denier, an enemy of the Prophet called Walid ibn Mughayre, who was one of the heads of Quraysh tribe. The ayahs say that God granted him ample properties and sons and provided him with all means of welfare and facility. But instead of thankfulness to God, he disbelieved Allah and denied the hereafter through calling the Prophet as a magician and preventing people from hearing his words. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number one, we should never boast of our wealth and facilities. We should never forget the day that we were born and couldn't do anything. We also shouldn't forget that one day we will die and won't be able to take any of these properties and facilities to the grave. Number two, the day of resurrection is very hard for the faithless and deniers of the truth. And number three, the Prophet has the mission of communication of Allah's revelation to people, and he leaves the faithless who fight his religion alone with him.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Russia, Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As Iran marks the anniversary of the failed U.S. military operation in the central Tabas Desert, people in the country say the Sands were the agents of God. A memorial ceremony was held in the capital, Tehran, with the event highlighting the budged American operation in which U.S. choppers crashed in the desert.
On April 24, 1980, the U.S. military carried out a cover operation in Iran by the order of President Jim Carter. The operation, dubbed Eagle's Claw, failed due to major sandstorms in the central Tabas Desert. The failed operation resulted in the death of American soldiers. Iranians believe the sands were the agents of God.
The botched American mission was an attempt to release 52 staff of the U.S. Embassy, known as the Den of Espionage, who had been held after the 1979 Islamic Revolution.
The incident of Tabas was a helping hand from the Almighty God to defend the great nation of Iran. And also the late founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, said the sands were appointed by God. Even the sand rose in support of the Iranian nation. And that bitter incident happened to the American regime.
Unlike the previous years, this year's memorial isn't just a history lesson. It is also an opportunity to reflect on Iran's recent anti-Israel retaliatory attack, dubbed Operation True Promise, which showed the true power of Iran's military forces. Since the failed U.S. Operation Eagle Claw, Iran has boosted and upgraded its defense capabilities and can now stand up to all kinds of threats.
And civilians will not hesitate to retaliate from our own land. The True Promise operation was executed in a specific manner which is classified right now. We use scores of drones, crews, and ballistic missiles with proper timing to successfully penetrate the complicated Israeli air defense systems and strike our targets with pinpoint accuracy.
Iran has shown that threats from its enemies have only strengthened its will to defend what belongs to the nation. And now it seems that the West has woken up to Iran's military powers after Operation True Promise.
Reza Hashemi, Tehran.
A recent United Nations report predicts that approximately 16 million individuals in Afghanistan will be struggling to gain access to food this year. To get a better understanding of the situation, we visited a family in Kabul facing acute food shortages. The Rukhshana family's daily struggle mirrors the difficulties faced by countless households across the country.
I lost my husband during the war in our hometown. I don't have a male provider, and I can't find a source of income. One of my grandkids polishes boots, but that is not enough for our family. It has been a long time since the last time we had rice and potatoes in our home. We barely eat two meals a day, which is stale breads and tea. My children are asking for soup, and I feel so bad as I can't make it for them.
Our situation here is so difficult that we can hardly survive. It is because there is no income or food to eat. If we eat during the day, we should sleep with empty stomachs at night. There are people who skip meals to feed their children. Some families beg for food but fail to find some because almost no one has a better situation. We used to receive some aid from the United Nations World Food Program, but now it is gone and has left people to their fate.
According to the UN report, the Afghan population cannot fulfill essential needs, including health care, food, employment, and shelter. Some local experts argue that the current hardships faced by Afghans stem from prolonged foreign interventions and conflicts, suggesting that those involved bear a responsibility to aid in the crisis resolution.
I think all the misery and economic hardships that Afghans are going through today stem from the shameful U.S.-West intervention and wars in Afghanistan.
If they had let us build constructive economic relations with our neighbors, we would not be so broken today. The U.S. and its allies are responsible because they came and destroyed our infrastructure here, and on the other hand, they imposed economic sanctions after their withdrawal. Today, they cannot turn a blind eye on what they have created.
As the international community's attention shifts away from Afghanistan and the foreign aid continues to shrink, the Afghan people still hope for a means of survival that will pull them back from the edge of crisis. Millions of Afghans are facing emergency levels of food insecurity and malnutrition. The UN agencies warn that the situation is expected to worsen rapidly if urgent action are not taken by the global community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
During the second day of his official visit, the Iranian president displayed a keen focus on strengthening cultural bonds with Pakistan. Traveling to Lahore, a city with rich cultural heritage, President Raisi was warmly welcomed upon his arrival by the Chief Minister of Punjab, Maryam Nawaz. He paid homage at the mausoleum of the revered Urdu and Persian poet Allama Muhammad Iqbal. Iqbal is held high esteem in Iran for his poetic works in the Persian language and is lovingly called Iqbal-e-Lahori by the Iranians. President Raisi emphasized that there was no sense of foreignness in Pakistan, underlining the deep historical and cultural connections between the two nations. President Raisi offered special prayers for the oppressed people of Gaza and lauded the Pakistani nation for its unwavering unity in championing the rights of oppressed people of Palestine. Meanwhile, the president paid a visit to the renowned University of Lahore and delivered a speech. In his address, President Raisi emphasized the deep historical, religious, cultural, and civilizational bonds between Pakistan and Iran. Raisi also said the common point of view of the people of Iran and Pakistan is the defense of the oppressed Palestinian nation. He asserted that the Islamic Republic will continue to defend the resistance and oppressed nation of Palestine with pride. President Raisi also warned that if Israel makes a mistake and attacks Iran's territory, it is clear that nothing will be left of the Israeli regime. Later, during consecutive meetings with the Chief Minister and Governor of Punjab, the Iranian President reassured Pakistani authorities of Tehran's commitment to collaborating in bolstering cultural and trade relations between the two nations.
President Raisi has devoted his second day of Pakistan visit to exploring the country's rich cultural heritage. Many believe that the Iranian President's trip will significantly contribute to boosting the bilateral trade and strengthening cultural relations between the two nations. Nasik Azmi, Lahore.
Dozens of organizations marched in Paris against Islamophobia and racism as Israel's attempted genocide and ethnic cleansing has caused increased state-sponsored repression against Europe's largest Muslim community. A main theme of the march was protecting children. Since October 7th, children as young as 10 years old have been charged with so-called apology for terrorism, while a child of 8 was falsely targeted for praying during recess. Scandals like those have many saying that non-white children are no longer being treated like children, but instead like suspected fanatics, delinquents, and full-grown adults.
We Muslims are enduring so much Islamophobia these days, and it's not like there wasn't a lot of Islamophobia in France already. The targeting of our children is a step too far, and it's incredible that they have taken this shameful step.
As France is accused of targeting Muslim children at home, their elite are giving military and political cover to Israel's mass murder in Gaza of an estimated 15,000 children and the orphaning of some 20,000 others.
On les bombarde.
It's totally unjust how we are watching murder, torture, and the bombing of embassies, and nobody is allowed to say anything. We're here to say stop the violence against Palestinian and Iranian people.
A decade ago, during another Israeli invasion of Gaza, France became the first country to ever ban pro-Palestinian demonstrations. They banned pro-Palestinian demonstrations for a month after the counterattack by Hamas on October 7th, handing out hundreds of thousands of euros in fines and making mass arrests. Police initially banned this march, claiming it was a threat to public order and